Monday, September 17th, LA Podcast. This is Scott Frazier with Hayes Davenport and Alyssa Walker.
Hello.
Fun week, exciting week. Alyssa, you went on a field trip this week.
I did. I went on a
LA
field
Podcast
trip.
Emissary to San Francisco for the go. What is the acronym?
I can never remember.
What was it? Where'd
Global
you go?
Global Action Climate Summit.
Flipped them. GCAS.
Global Climate Action Summit.
That's
see,
the one.
I don't. Yeah, you shouldn't. They should just name it.
Action climate is what we have now.
We would have decidedly less action. Yeah,
trying
less
to avoid.
Action. Yeah.
So we'll talk about that more a little bit later. We also have Bryn Lindblad from Climate Resolve coming to talk about LA's commitment to zero emissions. That'll be great. I'm very excited for that. A few stories for that. Well, let's tell our LA stories first. Who wants to go first?
I can go first this time. This one is interesting simply like from the perspective of housing, which we talk about all the time on this show. I am now with my partner looking for like a larger apartment than the one bedroom. We've been in a one bedroom almost our entire time in LA,
yeah,
except for a like 6 month period where we lived in a studio that got no sunlight whatsoever. So we're looking for a two bedroom apartment, and it's just kind of like the apartment hunt process in LA is so ridiculous. We would go to these open houses and there are just like 5-10 groups of people at once at an open house.
Yeah.
Basically like fawning over the landlord, like whoever they are, just like obsequiously like being like, I would be the best tenant ever. I like literally went to this place in Atwater Village where a woman forced the landlord to take a check from her when he was like, I already have like three people who've put in applications. I don't want to take your money. It's not, you know, it's whatever. And she like put it in his hand and was like, this is, you know, just in case anything happens, blah, blah, blah. And it just reminded me how difficult this process is. There's so little available, like anything that is not extremely overpriced, you end up with these crowds of people and you're like thinking back over every decision that you've ever made that could impact your credit score. Like, well, I guess I'm not the perfect tenant. I guess presumably you could find somebody who is making more money or has better references than me. And it just seems like
but that means you have to use your personality and kind of pick up artist techniques on the landlord.
It's like
to get in there, you have to establish Kino with your landlord.
It's like the pickup artist articles that you'll see where it's like, how do you talk to a woman if she has headphones on? Like the landlord is busy like taking an application from somebody else, but don't let that discourage you. You got to get up there and just establish your value or whatever. It's wild. It's really
terrible.
It's really ridiculous. So that was my past week.
Yeah, it's bad. I have a really short one. I went out to dinner with my brother-in-law and his friend who is in the weed business. And he told me that the weed business he is now pursuing a degree in microbiology. This was someone who I always
micro
kind of
weed.
Yeah. Yes. We're getting into tinier weed, but is now getting this advanced degree because the weed business has gotten so complicated. And he said it's not really about growing anymore. They're getting away from the physical plant to just taking the different noids, the cannabinoids and all that, and just like mixing them together.
Right.
And there's no, I mean, they do still have grow operations, but the future of it is like the immediate future has nothing to do with
just
like
all these kind of drops,
like
and
lichen, like a weed lichen.
Not even that.
Just the chemicals.
Drops, chemicals.
Just the drops.
Yes. There's nothing green about it, which I always thought it would be commercialized really fast. Tobacco was.
Is it synthetic then? That can't be real. Yeah. I mean,
I guess it's basically synthetic. Although synthetic weed now is like K2.
Yeah.
I think this is actual. I don't know anything about it.
It's just the chemical compounds.
I don't have a weed biology.
It's just the chemical compounds, but it is.
I'm picturing a clear eyedropper.
Right.
Yeah. It's so interesting. Yeah. You can like get those CBD drops at like basically any coffee shop in LA now.
Yeah.
I think that's spread like wildfire.
Yeah.
And what else? The MedMen thing that we mentioned briefly last week, like they're the major weed conglomerate and they're all about positioning themselves for, they say, the cannabis consumer of the future.
Yeah.
Which is somebody in Beverly Hills, according to them, or somebody on like Fifth Avenue in New York.
Well, their ads have like a picture of an older woman that has the word stoner crossed out and it says grandma underneath. Which I think is a bad ad because it kind of makes it seem like she quit weed.
To become a grandma.
And now she can really focus on being a grandma.
It does kind of sound like that. That is funny.
Alyssa, what's your LA story?
I mean, like you said, I was in San Francisco. So I was acting as the, you know, the Southern Californian in the strange world of Northern California.
Yeah. And guest recruiter. You got our guest for this episode
That's right. Because we have to, the climate women representing LA have to stick together. Mm-hmm. But tell me, can we just go over this? Have either of you lived in the Bay Area before?
No.
Okay.
Nope.
Why, when you go ride BART, do people line up waiting for the train to come? Like they line up where the door is going to be. There are the little markers on the ground and they line up like they're going like out to recess.
Yep.
And then they wait for the door to open and then they go in one by one.
Weird. Doesn't that stop people from getting out?
Well, the people come out. I mean, I can kind of see the idea of standing to the side so people can walk out of the door.
As they do in New York.
Right. Like as common courtesy of any subway. But literally lining up, and if you start to like edge towards the front, like people will step in front of you or say something to you.
Yeah.
Tell you to get to the end of the line.
I think it does go with the general sanctimoniousness of the Bay Area. I mean, if you're riding a normal subway system, they will stand to the side of the doors. There's like a common courtesy, like you said, letting people out, right, and then you board. LA is the jungle as far as public transit manners are concerned. People will fully block the exit and just force their way on. But that is much better than the Bay's lineup.
I mean, I just, like, where does this come from? Like, I searched a little bit and there was like some stories on transit etiquette, like telling, like informing people about the process and like what you should do. And also if it's not your train, to like step to the side and form another line, like wait.
Ridiculous.
It's just like, but why, how did this start? And maybe we do need better, you know, etiquette on our own subway, but I've never really found it to be a problem, nor am I angry if somebody gets on the train before me in that ugly, disgusting padded seat they have on BART, which they're getting rid of, but I don't want to sit down, to be honest, on those couches that navigate through the city.
This is related to something that happened this week. The new Superkind videos came out.
Oh, yeah. Right? Good.
Which are PSAs paid for by Metro, produced very well produced. I think the videos are funny. They're very well done. There was a good one with Danny Trejo. About people like waiting for people to get off before that they get on. There are also some that I find less kind of palatable, sort of demonizing vendors on the train and bus. On the train, I guess, for vendors.
People who have like bulky items with them, which typically speaking are either individuals who are homeless or people that are work jobs where they just have to carry a ton of stuff with them.
Or babies.
Or strollers.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And the question, I don't really blame the people that made these videos, the contractor. It wasn't their idea to do PSAs about this.
The direction.
Stuff. I think it's a signal to potential riders to say, hey, we're trying to make this a more pleasant experience for you, probably a higher income person who's choosing not to do this because you think there's all this like dirty stuff going on.
Why don't they make a PSA that's like, we are going to make the countdown clocks be accurate on the red line, and then you would want to ride the train more.
That would be amazing.
That would be
if they made a super kind video about disappearing the person who is responsible for the arrival screens to Pluto. I somehow feel like that video would not make it out of the boardroom. But
that guy is in the boardroom saying like, hey, maybe we focus on vendors.
It's pretty bizarre. You do, if you ride, if you hear what people say who don't commonly ride Metro, you do get the sense that most of the people that are perceived as unpalatable are low income riders, people of color.
Yeah.
And the PSA certainly reinforces that by singling out the behavior of people that are low income and people of color. So it's unfortunate to see that coming out of Metro.
Here's a very LA story, I think, from this week. There's a building on Hollywood Boulevard, the Palmer Building. It's on Hollywood and Cosmo. It used to have the Io West Theater in it, but that closed very abruptly in February, the Improv Theater. It was raided last week by SWAT, LAPD, all these, like they kicked the door in.
Yep.
Arrested a ton of people. The headlines were really dramatic of like guns were seized, drugs.
Yeah, it was kind of like in LA Confidential where they have like they do the photo shoot with all the things that they seize and they had like all the guns and everything laid out on the table. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. What it really seems like it was kind of a little artist's kind of squat where people were paying rent. Nothing. Some like $500, $600.
Yeah, it was one person we talked to at Curbed had paid, I think, $1,250 for 2 months. So that's $625 a month to live
for
with
a
no
room,
electricity.
Yeah, and a room made out of like curtains. This is all. This feels like something that's going on in a lot of these very high traffic, sometimes touristy areas. Residential properties are in really high demand there and get really expensive. But buildings like this, which are zoned commercial, all up and down Hollywood Boulevard are just completely vacant. And just like being allowed to fall into disrepair. Westwood Village is another example that's kind of the same way. This is an incredibly expensive area. But commercial properties are just going empty for months and months.
Yeah.
So I guess this is the thing that's confusing me about it. What is like kind of built into the incentives right now that encourages or allows buildings like this to just basically become blight in the middle of a really expensive neighborhood?
You can have a vacant building. There's vacant buildings all over the place. And like other cities have things like vacancy taxes and... We don't even know how many buildings are vacant. I feel
So it's it is interesting because there are instances where asking rents are. I think this goes to what Alyssa's talking about with the vacancy tax. Asking rents in order to like basically meet what is being achieved by other landlords in the area is so high that nobody can really afford that besides major chains that might already have be represented in the area. So there's no downward pressure incentivizing landlords to lower the commercial rents so that they can actually get a tenant.
They just let them stay empty.
Just let them stay
Make
empty.
Money off the building appreciating. And just maybe wait for a bank to come along or something.
Yeah, this is what you're seeing. I mean, I think they've taken some actions in places like New York because you go through these like Greenwich Village and there's empty storefronts everywhere. It's like hedge fund type of real estate squatting in a way. So it's like you're trying to wait for like the bigger, you know, you're waiting for Marc Jacobs to leave so the next more high-end chain can come in, right?
There was actually... an article in the New York Times either last year or the year before that I thought was so fascinating. I recommend anybody to check it out. It was about Bleecker Street and with Marc Jacobs and the development of luxury blight zones where it attracted so many high end brands and became so expensive that then like once those stores started shuttering or as they like moved their focus to online sales, nobody could afford to rent the spaces here.
Yeah.
And there was no incentive for the landlords to lower the asking prices. So you just end up with stretches in an extremely desirable part of the city where it's just vacant storefront after vacant storefront.
I think a lot of those buildings along Hollywood, like the one where we used to record this podcast when we first started.
I think I saw our building in that shot. I'm not sure.
Yeah, yeah. So we had this tiny little office right across the street from like Ripley's Believe It or Not that cost the whole lot. We had a room in the office that we paid $300 a month for. Which was nicer than these squats. I'm sure it had electricity. It wasn't nice, but it would have been a much more desirable place to live.
Yep.
But those buildings are only allowed to have offices in the upper floors. Like the Palmer Building, the reason it was an illegal squat is because you're only allowed to have a business there. So at what point do we say, like, okay, maybe the demand for commercial property and like renting offices is going down, the demand for people to live in these places is so high, obviously
extremely high, yeah,
based on the people that were living in this building. So at what point do we make it easier to maybe convert some of these offices into residential space?
Which is interesting too, because I think it gets back to something that I believe Mike Feuer's office brought up in relation to city attorney Mike Feuer brought up in relation to this raid, and also sort of has hung over discussions of housing and homelessness for the past several years, which is the Oakland ghost ship fire.
Yes.
Where you had a collaborative living space that was not zoned for residential, where people were living because they could not afford rents in Oakland that have just skyrocketed. So you end up with officials saying, like, we want to avoid that situation where I think 30 some odd people lost their lives.
And it's true. It is this like illegal wiring and stuff makes these places unsafe.
Right.
Like, it's not desirable for people to be living like that.
But we haven't, I guess, reached a point of discussion where those same officials are saying, like, we need to, like, this is an emergency situation. We should get these buildings up to code required for people to be able to live here. Instead, they're just saying, we need to shut them down. Now you have people going directly into homelessness.
Yeah. What's going to happen to these people? And I think it's also notable, we uncovered that the same guy who owns this building wants to develop a hotel down the street and owns many properties around the city, including the Belasco Theater downtown. So whether he knew this was going on or, you know, probably not. I don't want to say
maybe not the owner, but the
maybe
property
not the
manager.
Well, yeah,
for
whether, you know, who knows how their buildings are being used. But again, it's this big question of this top down looking at every single building, especially in a very dense place like Hollywood, where there are services nearby for people who might be, you know, recently might be homeless or might need, you know, any kind of mental health or substance abuse services. Like, we need to be looking at these solutions. And for a building to sit empty is horrible. It's horrible.
So then I think that it goes back to, we've had an issue with housing and homelessness in California, like, essentially forever, right? My grandparents moved out here from Louisiana, and they were living in a segregated part of the city at the time in somebody's garage in Huntington Park, because there were not enough housing units in the parts of town that they could live in. We've seen that continued to be a trend. Like, in the 80s and 90s, you had the garage apartment that became a symbol of Southern California's overcrowding crisis, as we had all these immigrants coming in from Central America.
Kato Kaelin living in a back house.
Exactly. Famously, yes.
Kind of symbolized the crisis.
those are Brentwood problems. That's somewhat different. but my point is just that when we fail to build enough housing to accommodate the demand to live here, we end up seeing a spike in these illegal rental situations. That has most recently been addressed not by city government, but by state government, who legalized the accessory dwelling situations, the garage apartments, the granny flats, which also acted as de facto amnesty for the millions of these units that
are
existing statewide.
Yeah.
So it's almost like we need that kind of amnesty for these illegal commercial living spaces. Yeah. That includes some kind of enforcement of bringing them up to code, but not kicking people out on the street.
The interesting thing happening on Tuesday at City Hall, the city council is voting on a measure that will probably benefit the city council members more than anyone else and just improve their quality of life in a really substantial way. They're voting to allow themselves to ban people who disrupt council meetings at City Hall.
Yeah.
If you've ever been to a meeting.
You can also watch online if you don't have to go. If you don't have time. Most
Although
people don't have
about
time.
Going.
There's something about being there and experiencing it in person.
Experiencing the drama.
We should have one of those people on the show. Just
sure.
Give their spiel.
No, I'm good.
I'm scared to even say their names.
I mean, it's like what we should say. Like, it's a few people who come to almost every council meeting because there's a public comment session.
And supervisor meetings.
And
these guys,
many, all different. They're very busy going to all these meetings all over town. And they're doing pretty much the same thing and almost reading the same script and doing some of the same characters, if you will.
The script is sort of a Tarantino-esque. If you go to any city council meeting, you will hear just a barrage of racial slurs, just like the most insane profanity. It's not a place you can bring a child.
Well, yeah, no. I mean, one meeting, Nuri Martinez, one of the council members, like got up and was like, I feel harassed as a woman. Things you just said were inappropriate. There are children here. I mean, she like laid into these people for doing this, which I was really appreciated that she finally said something. But then I don't know where the freedom of speech kind of open comment period, you know, has to remain open. So
that's
how
a big question.
Yeah.
I wonder how you guys feel about this. If they're allowed to ban disruptors from coming to council meetings, is that... does it have a chilling effect on free speech at these meetings? Like, what do you guys think? This is a good or bad idea?
The way that it works currently is that if you're at a public meeting like this, the meetings in the state of California are governed by like the Brown Law, the Brown rules for who has to be notified, transparency in government, and things like that. Also governing the ability of it's already a regulated space in the sense that of course you are entitled as a member of the public to speak, but you're not entitled to speak, for instance, while somebody else is speaking.
Yeah, or infinitely.
Or
you only
infinitely.
Get a certain amount of time.
The government can choose how long to allow each person to speak for. They can set rules for conduct as long as those rules, I think, are enforced equally and are, I assume, meeting some sort of standard of reasonability. So to me, having been to a lot of Metro board meetings and having been to a lot of city council meetings, you really do hear the most spectacular abuse hurled at everybody, specific people, nobody in particular. And as you said, it's racial slurs, it's homophobia, extreme xenophobic sentiments. So I
off topic too. It's not necessarily
not even on topic racial slurs.
You do kind of wonder like how that impacts the functioning of like just like the normal democratic processes. I wonder whether or not like the presence of a Wayne Spindler type.
Oh boy, here he comes. He's knocking on the door because you said his name. Wayne Spindler is a lawyer from Encino. He goes to every single meeting. He wears a cow puppet on his hand that does a lot of the talking for him.
He drew a picture of Herb Wesson hanging from a tree.
And a Klansman.
With the N-word on his chest.
A Klansman holding a noose. His apartment was raided after Herb Wesson filed a restraining order against him, and they found the kind of semi-automatic machine gun that has been illegal under the assault weapons ban for like 25 years.
Yep.
He's a truly terrifying figure.
Yeah.
And I wonder if he's hoping for some kind of legislation like this to come down so he can sue. He's a lawyer.
Yeah.
I believe still has his license.
I think so. And I actually think you're right. I think that a lot of these people, the intention is to, that's why they call them gadflies, right?
Yes.
The intention is to provoke some kind of reaction. But I personally think that, I mean, there's a chilling effect in terms of if you're a person of color, if you're as current Metro board member Sheila Kuehl, if you are a member of the LGBTQ community, why should you have to be abused just for showing up and doing your job?
Yeah.
And to Sheila Kuehl's credit, you know, she's very strong and doesn't just say like, okay, you've spoken your piece. She will respond to people that are being extremely disrespectful of all people in the room.
Yeah, she'll get after them.
In a way that I think is good and admirable, but that should not be a requirement in order to be an elected official.
No.
Or, you know, like I wouldn't fault anybody for being unable to maintain their composure in that situation, in which case it becomes very difficult, like I said, as a member of a typically marginalized community to be an elected official, which I think is more concerning than Wayne Spindler's ability to do that.
Yeah. What do you think?
I mean, just being to some of these things, I just think about the kid thing. Like if I was taking my daughter's like class to see how
field trip is completely
works.
Out of the question.
So that's just, I mean, there's basic codes of decency and like, and code of conduct and like many things that you go to. So I don't know why we couldn't implement something similar. And then, yeah, of course you have like three strikes and you're out or something like that type thing. Like you'd get a warning. It's not like they're trying to silence certain voices or something like that.
Yeah.
If I were to change anything, I would say just make it like, so for instance, for like a for public service providers, Metro is a go-to for me. Like you can be suspended from using Metro services for like a year, for example.
Ooh, and I think,
oh wow, yeah sure.
Okay,
and I think
I'm
that
down.
That makes sense. And then and then you get a chance to come back and get kicked out next year.
Yes, basically. Yeah,
awesome. I agree.
That sounds good. That sounds good.
Very quickly, we had our first announcement, sticking with the city council, of a candidate for 2020. And it is Rochelle Huizar is running for the Council District 14 to take the seat of her husband, Jose Huizar, who is being termed out. We have the potential for an old-fashioned political dynasty in L.A. Downtown, this is a district that most famously covers Broadway. Jose Huizar is very focused on bringing back Broadway.
Mm-hmm. Also Boyle Heights and El Sereno. But Huizar has been extremely popular in the district for his three terms. He was embroiled a couple years before the Me Too movement in a sexual harassment,
which then he claimed was, he said, a consensual relationship with, I believe, an aide, which led to him apologizing to his wife. There's some Clinton-esque
parallels. This sounds familiar.
Yeah, so he has this clout in downtown, and potentially they do want a Huizar dynasty.
And I've been noticing for the last couple of years, he's been mentioning his wife a lot on his Twitter account. I think this has been in the works for a while. Like her plan to take this seat. I don't know if it's a good idea to have a couple families running city politics.
And isn't also like a super early announcement? That's what so like how many he's got years left.
It's the 2020 election.
Yeah, because they have extra long terms this time because of the way that we're redoing our election schedule. So has anyone else even announced from other council districts? I mean,
I'm sure that whatever, like Zuma Dog from Malibu has announced.
The first major,
he has a standing announcement that he's going to run in every election he can. But no, this
first
is
major announcement, I would
incredibly
say.
Incredibly early.
And very early. Yeah. So. Bringing back Broadway.
Great guest today, Bryn Lindblad from Climate Resolve, which is a local climate change activism organization who Alyssa hung out with at GCAS.
No one said that. No one said that.
Cool. It sounds better than.
I don't know what we say.
She's going to talk about what where LA is at now in terms of emissions and temperatures and livability and how we can make it better in keeping with the theme of climate change this week from the summit. And so we are going to talk to her right now.
All right, so we have a guest. Since as we talked about earlier, I was at the Climate Summit this week, which we can't remember what the initials stand for, but we... do you have
Global
trouble remembering?
Climate Action Summit.
I can never say it right. So I just say the summit or the Climate Summit, right? So we have Bryn here with us, who we introduced earlier, and maybe you can just tell us a little bit about where... Well, first of all, you work for Climate Resolve, which you can tell us about, and then tell us... what your role was. You were a delegate. This is so exciting.
Delegate amongst many. Yeah. So I'm Bryn. Climate Resolve. We're a local LA-based org. I'm working on climate solutions. So both trying to help people get around, live their daily lives without emitting as many greenhouse gas emissions, and also trying to help prepare our communities for the impacts of climate that we're already seeing. But up at the summit, yeah, it was a grand show. It was
Jerry Brown show is what I kept calling
the
it.
The Jerry Brown show, and all these commitments after commitments, people making pledges.
A lot of pledges.
We kept. I mean, throughout the course of the week, I feel like we kept seeing more and more things coming out that it was like, oh, Jerry Brown signed this. There was the executive order that he signed that was to make the entire California economy carbon neutral by 2045 that mm-hmm. people were saying flew under the radar. Was it like, I don't know, when you were there, was that just constantly like a buzz of new announcements?
Yeah, it's kind of like, what's next? People.
I worry about future politicians. Where, like, how do you go below zero emissions? But they have to pledge something.
I mean, but that was a tough thing because just to back up for the announcement. So we knew, and maybe you can explain first, we knew SB 100 was likely going to be signed. And that is, and you can tell us about SB 100, first of all. We knew the governor was going to sign this likely this week.
Yeah. So SB 100, that's saying California, we are on a path to having all of our electricity carbon free by 2045.
That was pushed by Kevin De Leon, who is now running for Senate against Dianne Feinstein. It was kind of a signature bill for him.
Yeah. But, you know, there's parts of the economy that are besides electricity. You know, we know transportation is a large source of our emissions here in California. And so then the economy-wide executive order by Brown, that's getting at a number of other things. And I think sequestering carbon in our natural lands is going to be a part of that, as well as in building materials, mm-hmm. putting carbon, injecting carbon into building materials.
So the difference is, just for people who don't understand all this stuff, which I barely do, the thing he's actually signed is just for
electricity,
right? Mm-hmm. So it only focuses on our power generation that we handle, you know, in the state. But this is saying an executive order that he really just kind of like turned around and signed and like ran away. Like nobody knew it was coming. Like maybe you guys knew it was coming, but like people who are preparing to cover this summit, we had all these like narratives ready to go. And this idea that we would now be carbon neutral, which means that we're going to, in a way, like offset, you know, everything that we're doing as far as emissions. Some of the later thing announcements during the week were like, had not even taken that into consideration. So for example, like LA's goal needs to be updated now because the state's goal is behind the state's goal. Right. So I think we were all taken by surprise. Did you know about this? Did you know? Yeah.
Well, we knew he was going for something big. He wanted to be the headline. We didn't quite know what it was going to be.
So that was really interesting.
As far as what Climate Resolve does, as you described to us, you work a lot on dealing with the already emerging impacts of climate change and helping people move away from climate or from greenhouse gas emissions. Have you given a lot of thought to what Los Angeles might look like as a carbon neutral region? Like, is that too far afield for the work that you guys do, or what, like, really, what could that look like?
What could that look like? Yeah.
What if she said she'd not thought about it at all?
This is my dreams. This is, I can't get away from these thoughts. Yeah. we're doing a lot in the transportation space because that's, there's a lot to be done yet there. We're not on a path that where emissions have peaked yet. We're still climbing.
Right.
We're really trying to stop that outward sprawl direction where people need to be in cars by themselves, driving long distances. You know, a lot of us have interest in building that affordable housing closer to where people need to be going. So that's part of the vision.
One example that we've talked about on the show that maybe you could just use as illustration. We talked about this Tejon Ranch Centennial development. And I was talking about a different development that's also kind of just as far away from LA, but there's Climate Resolve helped this other development, Newhall, you know, do better, like, right? So
yeah, so Newhall, they've made a commitment to being a net zero master plan community. And so a number of that is taking place on the footprint of the development with solar generation and electric vehicle chargers. But then there is going to be some offsets offsite. And so we're helping them figure out what can be done locally by energy retrofitting local schools, putting solar panels on low-income houses in LA County. and just trying to do as much of that locally as possible. And then beyond that, they'll be doing also some cook stoves in Africa.
And this is ideally to offset the emissions that will be caused by all the traffic going to and from this development to LA, yeah. which will be pretty substantial.
So, yeah. so the Tejon Ranch, for comparison, they don't have a Metrolink connection, which is could be a big plus in their favor. And they're a little bit further away, and there's also some environmental issues as far as natural habitat. But what could they possibly could they get to the level of what Newhall is going to be, or is it kind of an impossible thing? And we should definitely say don't do this, guys.
It's a hard hill for them to climb, just given location so far away from any existing transit facilities and job centers. So it feels a little bit to me like we're trying to fit a square peg in a round hole. And so they haven't taken on that ambitious level yet of trying to get to net zero. So
just
we'll
don't
see.
Build it in your opinion.
And I do think this was a big part of the conversations at the climate summit. I mean, it was a wide ranging discussion, and there was Al Gore all fired up and Harrison Ford fired up. And you probably saw some good Dave Matthews was a delegate. Matthews, I don't know. Did you hang out with Dave Matthews is my question. But I think the one thing that just kept coming up is maybe the part of the conversation that hasn't been talked about enough, especially since we were in California, is the transportation part, and specifically the density that will help us achieve these goals without having to, make every car electric, which is also a problem. And there were all these protests too about how even the city of San Francisco is so hypocritical, and how can Jerry Brown be having this summit there? I mean, what was your sense when you were walking around? There were a lot of really good protests, I felt like, that were, very visible and
entertaining. Yeah, no, the protests, I mean, it plays a part of sort of pointing out what's not on the agenda at the summit. And I think you're right. I think, the commitments, the pledges that were being made, it was large actions that corporations can make to be reducing their footprint. There was a lot about electrifying transportation, but when it comes to sort of those individual choices of whether to drive or take the bus or bike or walk, that trying to steer and make those decisions more aligned with the climate targets was not part of the discussion.
Let's talk about there was a speech at the summit made by our mayor, Eric Garcetti. I had the privilege of being on a text chain with Scott and Alyssa while we were watching this speech live, and just sort of watch a head explode in real time.
Saw me making my faces, but through the text chain, these grimaces that I was making.
Yeah. But I think it was reflective of a lot of stuff going on to the summit, which was they did definitely address the transportation issue, but mostly from the perspective of electric vehicles, switching cars
or
to
we're
electric.
Building rail. Yeah. So I think the three major things that the mayor talked about was electrification of our fleet vehicles and the rail effort we're building, and the port, which has actually done pretty good as far as getting emissions. They've achieved their goals early, but the week before the summit, the city announced something kind of the zero emissions transportation goal. Do you want to talk quickly about that before we talk about the mayor's speech?
Yeah, so it's this roadmap for the next 10 years leading up to the Olympics to try to get to a point where all of our local transit buses are 100% electric. I'm trying to get to the point where all the TNC, the Ubers and the Lyfts out there in LA are all electric. Adding in a bunch of new chargers to make it easier for individuals to also be using electric vehicles. And also getting at the medium duty, those little delivery trucks, and the heavy duty, the big trucks that are out there, not fully electric in those sectors, but starting to see much more than we do now.
And the goal for private vehicles, I thought this was interesting because there was pretty solid goals on the roadmap for all other things, but it was private vehicles by 2028. 20-45% will be electric. It was a big leeway in there, right? So it was maybe this, maybe that, which, okay. I mean, it's good that we now have a goal, even if it's a wide goal. But again, from this talk, it's continuing to push electrification without a single message in the mayor's speech about I'm going to make sure we build out the best protected bikeway system that allows people to get anywhere in the city, you know, on their own power. You know, that's the real zero emissions transportation.
He sounded like he was kind of sending a message to car manufacturers. He actually said, if you build it, we will drive, which means
it doesn't get more direct than that. Actually.
Maybe say, wow. But the whole thing did kind of feel, and then he was followed, I believe, by someone from Hyundai and Lyft and
yeah, ChargePoint.
The whole thing kind of felt like a trade show for electric vehicles. Yes. So I guess my question is, say we get to 100% electrification of vehicles, do you and Climate Resolve kind of consider that a goal in and of itself? Is that enough to get us where we need to be in terms of this being a habitable, sustainable city?
No. So with electric vehicles, all the sort of the tires and the braking out there, we still get a lot of particulate matter in the air. Huh. So it's still making it unhealthy air to breathe.
So we should not brake. just hit the gas.
Pedal to the metal. No. But it also, I mean, streets clogged with electric vehicles are just as frustrating for people to live through as streets clogged with internal combustion engine cars. Right. So, you know, I think for it to be a livable city, we really need to be helping people not have 2-hour commutes, not being stuck in that gridlock that is just.
So the solution is not everybody having an electric vehicle that they also sleep in because it is autonomous and never stops moving.
circling just so you could stay asleep. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, there was another great bill. As far as the Jerry Brown show, the other great installment was he signed a bunch of bills on the first hybrid electric ferry crossing the bay into the day of the summit, which was just an amazing photo op. But he signed a bunch of transportation related bills that day as well. And one of them, you mentioned TNCs, which is transportation network companies. Not good at acronyms. Places like these companies like Uber and Lyft. And tell us about what that bill, as far as electrification for the TNCs, would do.
Yeah, so it's charging Public Utilities Commission and California Air Resources Board with setting some goals and making these TNC companies develop plans for how they are going to have their fleet of cars become more electrified and reducing the emissions per passenger mile traveled. So part of it is electrifying the vehicles. Part of it is also getting more pooled rides and not just one passenger in the car, but trying to optimize and have more passengers.
And what I always tell people when they tell me that like autonomous vehicles will be so great is that they'll be shared. And I'm like, do you share your rides right now? Because it's totally possible for you to share your rides right now. And they kind of look at you like, huh. Right.
You don't actually need an app to do that.
Yeah, you don't.
Right.
Can use an app to do that doesn't need to be autonomous. Right.
There's all this potential.
And it's interesting that Lyft was a big presence at this summit. Uber too. I went to events, you know, from both of these companies, and Lyft announced that it's going to be carbon neutral as well, I think by some date. I don't know if
they're offsetting.
This is carbon neutral for their entire operations, maybe not just rides or something. Anyway, they stepped it up. Everybody, you know, they're one upping. Then Uber announced something, you know, whatever. So, but just looking at what that would look like if we could do something like that and push more people onto these types of vehicles, say you really don't need a car, we'll subsidize your rides. In places like Santa Monica, they want to replace several low ridership bus routes. And I think the Big Blue Bus, are they electric already? They will be soon. Doesn't matter.
Gas.
But anyway, they'll be electric soon. So is this part of this solution, at least as far as like the getting people out of their cars and saying, okay, you could sell your car, you could have a fairly subsidized or cheaper electric vehicle access through something like Uber and Lyft. Is this kind of where the city should be going to make sure this can help people's, you know, get past their car ownership problems?
Yeah, I mean, I think if we're replacing people having to own their own cars, sure, I think there's a lot of benefit there. Not having to store parked cars that aren't being used the majority of the time, not having to insure, people having to personally insure vehicles. I think you can help cut some of the cost of living in LA that way. What I worry about, I don't want ride share trips necessarily leading to a decline in public transit service. I think, you know, there's always the danger that these TNC companies will hike their prices and then people who don't have cars are kind of are stuck having to pay for that.
That worried me too. And I was just kind of curious about how Santa Monica, they already do, like, they use Lyft as their late night ride, call it like dial a ride. So if you summon a trip from the Expo line within the city of Santa Monica at like, you know, till 3 a.m. or something like that, when the Big Blue Bus starts running again, it's only $3, which I think is maybe a good use, but replacing the bus lines all the time with the TNC, even if it's cleaner. So you start to go through this whole like math of, like you said, like, are we clogging the roads with a bunch of subsidized TNCs, or should we make sure that we have the clean bus be the goal and get more people on it? So
something I think we've mentioned on this show before that it always shocks me about rideshare companies is that they spend as much time without a passenger as they do with a passenger. So the ratio of driving around in an empty car and with the passenger is 1-1, which is, that makes it seem like they're clogging the roads a lot more than someone just driving and parking would.
So for instance, if I were going to take a trip to a grocery store a mile away, and I were to drive myself, it would be a mile. And if I were to call a Lyft, it would actually be 2 miles driven.
Yeah.
And that's assuming that it's not causing me to take a car when I otherwise would have walked or biked. And that's a concern that people have.
So imagine if there was a electric cargo bike outside of your house.
Yeah.
And you had a dedicated path from your house to the grocery store.
Just imagine.
Wouldn't that be a lot cheaper and a lot better?
But so a question that I have about this law that was just signed by Jerry Brown regarding the TNCs is that of regulatory enforcement. Do you know if there was any component detailing how the Public Utilities Commission and the California Air Resources Board to state organizations are going to actually enforce these goals that they're now setting?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's the threat that they can lose their permit to operate.
Right.
So if they're not playing along and preparing these plans and if agencies become unsatisfied with their effort to try to implement their plans, I think there is that threat.
I have a question about LA, just kind of like a broader question. You hear about from people who lived here in the 70s and before that the air was so awful. It was just like basically unlivable. And now it's so much better. How is our air quality right now? How does it compare to other places? Like, is it healthy to breathe the air in LA right now?
We went all of July and August of this year, and we're still on a streak of not passing the federal air quality standards for ground level ozone.
Wow. Our ozone levels are unhealthily high every single day in July and August, and I think maybe all but like 4 days of June. June was also bad.
Yeah.
So we've
got a ways to go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But no. I don't think people realize that the air quality is still, because it doesn't look as smoggy.
Right. I mean,
they
always try to talk about people who have worked on these issues for a long time talk about how we basically solve the smog problem in many ways. And in major cities, yes, but you'll go to the Central Valley, you know, when you go maybe to the climate summit, and a lot of these people are maybe driving their EVs through the Central Valley or flying over it, or like you took Megabus, which is amazing. And you go on the 5, right? Obviously, mm-hmm. That's the fastest way. And you go through these communities that are still have their air quality is much worse than places on the coast, and largely because of things that we continue to do.
I wish someone had asked Harrison Ford if he took his single occupancy plane that he is famous for almost killing himself in every couple of years to probably the least environmentally friendly way to travel, which he does mostly for joyrides. I don't know. I wish someone had
saved somebody
him.
That Maybe one time. He rescued people. Pledge. He rescued someone right. one time. So, yeah.
Well, something that's working against us on air quality here in the Los Angeles basin is, as temperatures are getting hotter, it contributes to ozone formation. So, you know, we might still have the same amount of pollution, but as the temps are getting higher, it causes more asthma and more respiratory illness.
I remember about a year ago, an article came out saying that emissions supposedly had gone down, but the ozone levels had stayed where they were or gone up in LA. And that's because of higher temperatures.
Yeah. And we're getting hit by higher temperatures more so than other places in the country. It's climate change kind of has unequal impacts from place to place. And in our urban areas, it is especially high. The number of extreme heat days are somewhere, some places tripling by the middle of the century, so within the next 30 years.
There are some cool things, I will say, that you and the city are doing. There's, maybe you've heard about these cool pavements and cool roofs. And so what are these, I guess, or is this the other part of it? You know, we've talked a lot about emissions, but actually physically cooling our city with these cool roofs and trees, of course.
We all love trees. Yeah. And I'll say they do go hand in hand. So cool roofs. This was LA was the first major American city to pass a cool roofs ordinance 3 years ago. And that it means that our new rooftops and refurbished roofs need to be more reflective than they were in the past. So it keeps neighborhoods cooler, sort of the ambient temperature, but it also reduces the cooling needs, the energy needs for the buildings. And next
more
up,
reflective is
more reflective.
But how does that look? Is it white paint? Is that basically what it comes down to?
For flat industrial roofs, it can be as simple as a white paint.
Okay.
For residential roofs, people don't really like the looks of that. So uh-huh. It's a little higher tech there. And it's shingles that come in all different colors.
Okay.
And just have been designed to have higher albedo, higher reflectivity.
Got it.
But next up, we're going after streets because the asphalt in our city really does. It contributes a lot more heat, heats up the urban environment much more than it needs to, anywhere up to 25 degrees hotter than it needs to be. And so we did a pilot project in the city of LA last summer where they tried putting down cool streets. So it's a lighter colored slurry.
Basically paint everything white.
Wow.
It's just the rule.
Start looking like grease. but yeah, no, people liked it. It cools down the air temperature there, 10, 20 degrees, depending
wow.
on how hot the day is. So.
Then we need trees, a full canopy to be growing, because that would, in that, even that little block would be, I saw some of these where they put the, you know, they're painting the streets white and there were no trees still on the side of the street. And I was like, okay, we're missing like the part of the puzzle here.
Right. Well, shade cools even more than the reflective surfaces. So a combination of the two can really, and that, you know, it cools down the temp, but it can help people want to get out of their cars too, I think, and want to be out walking and waiting for the bus.
Do you feel like there's the climate resolve, the focus on housing construction as a solution for emissions, that you guys have sort of gone in a different direction of stuff that we sometimes hear from climate organizations like the Sierra Club, maybe sometimes better known institutions that tend to focus, be a little more anti-development, focus more on electric vehicles and preserving green space than building up the city? I don't know. Is there kind of an ideological divide now in this world?
You know, there is. I don't like to try to reinforce that because, you know, I'll welcome
sure.
them over
I'll do it.
Into that. I like to bridge that divide as much as possible and welcome those more traditional environmental groups into a more inclusive vision that sort of uplifts all.
Great.
So it's but yeah, no, it's you know, the climate crisis can also be seen as a housing crisis that people are just forced to live farther from where they need to be.
I mean, so last week's event was called the Global Climate Action Summit. It's like you said, the impacts of climate change are extremely disparate from place to place. Here we're seeing that smog is going to start rebounding and getting worse again, even as people are living in more compact dense environments. So what do we need to do in Los Angeles? And how much more extreme is it because we have no control over the global warming of temperatures? You know, like, what is the thing that we can most do locally that would offset the impact of heat on our smoggy days, our unhealthy air days here?
Yeah, well, we can achieve a lot of cooling if we transform our asphalt. 40% of the city is covered in asphalt. So there's a lot that can be done there. And we're working at it. We've convened a little City of LA working group, call ourselves the Urban Cooling Committee. Mm-hmm. Co-host it together with Tree People, another local nonprofit. And are working on setting targets and figuring out how to get it to be part of the city budgeting process, that this just becomes the way of doing business. That when
cooling
we're resurfacing
or something. Yeah. Because right now the hard thing about streets is you know, any city street you look at, it's like 5 or 6 different agencies responsible for every single resurfacing, curb, light, tree, you know, bench, you know, yeah. It's like all these different agencies. So if one place could be just overseeing cool.
Do you think that that's, I mean, like, is that too much asphalt? Like, it covers 40% of the city. Like, that seems like almost like an argument for road diets that I haven't heard yet. Like,
it's also parking lots, though, right? Parking would that lots, be? Yeah. Yeah. So it'd be parking lots and.
Well, I'm dead set against
and,
the parking
lots. Well, yeah,
lot,
of course.
So.
Duh. But yeah, but yeah, no, I don't think most people know that. I don't think people think about it. It's like the same thing. Like, we're car blind. We're also, like, you know, asphalt blind, which is the big thing, but everybody says that's why you see problems with scooters and bikes and people walking, because you are so used to seeing cars. And I think not just looking at a street that in front of you as part of like a regular part of the LA landscape and seeing that it's 6 lanes wide.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just a normal street, just yep. a normal, you
every
know,
street in
every
the valley.
Street. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that alone should be. That's the place. That's where we have to focus on.
Is there a pilot neighborhood for the asphalt treatment that you guys are exploring? You could do like a Santa's Village kind of thing where people can just walk around and experience the cool temperatures.
Next up is doing a 1 square mile around in Canoga Park around the Sherman Way Orange Line station. It's a particularly hot spot. A lot of people that are currently walking to the transit station there. A lot of retail that is served by people walking to it. And so thought that would be a good area to try to preserve that walkability and help keep it cooler. That's next up. It's in planning stages coming up.
So as far as next steps, I want to talk about 2 things. The our mayor got up there and, you know, I don't know if he really talked about specifically the Olympics type goal. So that's 10 years, right? I don't know if he talked about it in that speech, but he had some other appearances.
I'm going to guess that he did.
No, but he didn't talk about like how we were going to get there, like you talked about,
right.
Like how this, you know, the details of like the personal cars turning to EVs. Because there was a really great Siemens study out a few weeks ago that said that to achieve some climate goal, maybe from the state or something, that we would have to get to active transportation. 45% of the population would have to use active transportation every day. So if you, and that includes walking, biking, and getting to the train, for example, you know, something where you were not in like your car. So how it's single digits right now for more people walk than bike in LA. They walk to work, walk for trips, for a small amount bike. Transit ridership is about
7%.
Right. So, okay. So imagine all that chunk maybe is maybe a little bit over 10%, right? So now we need to get to 45. How do we do it?
How do we do it? Yeah. I mean, I think cooling down our streets, getting people shade makes it more appealing. I think as we're shifting out internal combustion engines for electric vehicles, you also have less waste heat coming from those vehicles. There's nothing I like less than being on a bicycle behind a big CNG bus that is spewing out heat in my face.
The cooling is a big factor, and the like presence of shade trees and everything, especially in a region like LA, where it's one of the political realities of Southern California that most households have access to a private car if they so choose. So you're implicitly competing with, do I want to walk for a half mile when it's very hot and I'm walking in this sun blasted environment? Or do I want to be in my climate controlled car?
Mm-hmm.
It's a major deciding factor that impacts hundreds of thousands and millions of people every day. So just like getting the walking environment more pleasant would make a big difference.
Oh.
And it wouldn't be an episode of this show if we didn't advocate for dedicated bus lanes at
Yay.
Some point.
Yep.
I mean, there's been a lot of discussion about swapping out the entire fleet for electric vehicles, but that is not going to increase use of those vehicles at all. That's not going to get that percentage up. They have to actually change the infrastructure, maybe go back to that article in the LA Times that you found, that ad for the Silver Lake neighborhood where they were advertising buses to downtown, I want to say
every 90 seconds.
Every 90 seconds instead of now 20 minutes, like 20 minutes.
It wasn't, what year is that? It was like.
That was in the mid 20s. Like
yeah. So they were developing this neighborhood.
Yeah.
So something a little closer to that would be nice, which would require dedicated lanes.
Yeah. And as far as long as we're talking about dedicated lanes, the city is about to allow micro mobility companies to come in. Santa Monica's pilot starts on Monday, where they're going to have Uber, Lyft, Lime, and Bird do this very structured scooter and e-bike pilot. Ours, city council has approved that we're going to allow some of the companies to come in and get permits. But again, without a place for people to ride them, there's just going to be, we could flood the city with these and people still won't feel safe enough to ride. Right. And we need those lanes. We need that asphalt back.
Yeah. No, and I think it needs to be kind of a comprehensive corridor approach where you're asking cities to give up some of that curbside parking to put in dedicated bus lanes and create that safe space for bicycles and pedestrians to get through, and in return they get some shade trees, they get some cool bus shelters, and so it's this sort of carrot and stick a little bit, but try to transform what those streets look like.
We haven't talked about autonomous vehicles. Everyone kind of says in any of these conversations that, well, just wait for autonomous vehicles to come, that'll save all these problems. They'll be able to move with perfect efficiency and get everyone where they need to go in an electric car, and so we won't have problems anymore. Do you think that's true? Are you waiting for autonomous vehicles to come and save the environment for us?
Autonomous vehicles are not my savior. I'm not not counting on that. No, I mean, I think it creates this danger of us just spreading out further and trips becoming longer as people can multitask more. So no, I don't see that as like a healthy direction necessarily.
Okay.
I think we need to put some checks on that. Also don't know that that autonomous vehicles are affordable to everyone, unless we put some safeguards on that.
Sure.
Our very likely next governor, Gavin Newsom, is quite interested in the 3D space too. What what we can do for mobility if we're bringing people off the surface level,
either below, both below and above.
So that would be Harrison Ford's private plane service.
Right, Harrison Ford and Elon Musk team up to tackle the sky and the subterranean world.
One more thing I just wanted to ask is, what now on a global perspective? What happens next? Will we have this summit again next year when Brown is going out of town? Like, what do we get? What happens?
New York's hosting the next summit next year, 2019. I think there's still at the national scale, the big conference of parties, UN conference gets held in Poland. And so I think part of the goal of this summit was that these subnational actors can deliver a strong message that the U.S. is still into the Paris Agreement. There's still efforts underway to be on par with all these other national efforts to reduce emissions. So trying to send that signal back and make sure that the global scene is still motivated and knows that we're sort of all in it together.
One thing Al Gore said when he was on stage was like, technically, we're not even out of the Paris Agreement because the day it kicks in is like the day after the next presidential election.
Yeah.
So it doesn't even really matter. Which
it's kind of a referendum on the Paris Agreement. Right. Could have been a little more ambitious.
Could have kicked in a little soon. So, yeah, I guess it makes midterm elections, for example, and the next presidential election even more important as Harrison Ford. I didn't know I was going to be talking that much about Harrison Ford today, but he had a really good line, whoever wrote it for him, or maybe he wrote it himself, but it was like, stop electing politicians who don't believe in science or believe that they don't for their own personal gain, which I feel like is even happening in the state of California and was such really spoke to me as someone who's covering a lot of these issues, hopefully to you too. Thanks so much for being here with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you. That was so fun. Thank you, Bryn. One thing we were talking about as she was leaving that I thought was really interesting that we should talk about more is AAA, the auto club in LA and around the country, being a lobbying organization that we should pay more attention to as responsible for there being so many cars on the road, for the streetscape.
It's being really hostile to pedestrians.
Being what it is.
Preventing dedicated bus lanes from going in.
Yeah, they lobby against this stuff really hard. And I think a lot of us are members of this organization.
Not me, Hayes.
Okay.
Not me.
Oh, I think I am. I'm not sure.
Burned my card. I burned it.
But I think we don't make this connection. The AAA is a lobbying organization in the same way that the NRA is. And by joining this organization, you are supporting their lobbying efforts in a way that I think people mostly don't understand. Oh, yeah. I get free roadside service, whatever.
Yeah.
But as Bryn pointed out, a lot of insurance companies like Geico, whatever, also offer that same service. So there are other options. So I guess I'm going to have to burn my card as well. If I have one, I probably lost it.
I mean, what most people don't know, locally, their headquarters is downtown by USC on Figueroa, and they were very against My Figueroa going in with the new bike and ped improvements and bus lane improvements. And as you go by, they have this big parking garage entrance on Figueroa that's like no access to pedestrians. And I always like to take a big picture there with like my, you know, my finger in the air. I don't really know that, but you should.
Every more, check out Alyssa Walker's Instagram.
I run the Say No to AAA Instagram account. You can see more of my work on there.
Thank you for listening. See you next week on LA Podcast.